Everyone, please take a seat. Thank you. So at this time, before going to the next speaker, we had some board members who had questions for you, Dominic, so this is the time. And I'll start with Mr. Young.
So Dominic, this symposium that you're putting on mm-hmm. on Monday, who is the intended audience?
Let me clarify that we are hosting it in the sense of physically hosting it. The actual sponsor and promoter of the event is the Local Government Commission, and with in coordination with the Office of Emergency Services and I think OPR, Office of Planning Research. They're hosting this large event here and in Santa Cruz, and the intended audience is local agencies and primarily agency folks, but we're definitely bringing in folks from the NGO and community and the collaboratives, the climate collaboratives, in particular the Central Coast Climate Collaborative, which will be the subject of the next speaker, will be very much a part of producing the event.
Okay, thank you.
We're providing the venue, essentially. That's it.
They're letting me come, Jeff. I registered, so you're welcome to ride with me if you want to come.
Go ahead.
If now's not the time because of time constraint, that's okay. But I think I and maybe other board members, but I'll just speak for myself, would like to have some time with staff in some venue, personal or public, to understand some of these concepts that I don't understand, such as the emergence and issue of, you know, how does sea level rise cause emergence, and what is emergence? And anyway, these concepts that came up today that I didn't understand, what can we do about that?
John, why don't you take that?
So one thing we can do is we can provide board members technical, like workshops. You're familiar with that concept. That's one possibility. We could also have more opportunities with the public, you know, stakeholders and the board, and have the individual come here and do more workshop-y approach than an informational item, so that it's really focused on that exchange of information. And it's a little bit slowed down pace too, so that we could get into the details of it. That's an option also. So I think both of those options exist. We'll talk about it, and we can talk about it too, Mr. Delgado. And see what concept, you know, we can talk to the board at large and see what concept works best for the collective.
All right, thank you. I know you can work something out. My last question is kind of a reality check for us to do what we think we need to do to stay on top of this. It seems like a large workload, and I can tell from the presentation you're doing all you can. But in reality, do we really have the bandwidth for an adequate job?
I think we have to. I don't think we have a choice. I mean, we're not gonna nail it perfectly. This won't be an immaculate adaptation, but I think we have to adapt organizationally. And I think staff is already on it. We have to do more, but in terms of selling staff to integrate this with their work as they execute different programs and program strategies, I think it's becoming more ingrained, using the MPDS program as an example. With new orders that we issue, we will include an expectation for reporting out from the entity on what their climate change strategies are relative to infrastructure safety, just as a micro example. So I think we have to. As far as the bandwidth issue and capacity, Dominic already spoke to, we'll have to make hard choices about our prioritization and what we do and what we don't do. Something will fall off the plate,
right?
Because there's finite bandwidth, to go to your metaphor.
And that's what worries me. A pink flag went up in my mind. I remember a few years ago, former assistant executive officer, at a Watsonville workshop we had, showed a line across a graph below the line, we weren't going to get to all those tasks. And some of those were required by EPA, and some of those seemed important and mandatory, and we just weren't going to get to them. So when I hear Dominic earlier today saying, yeah, well, some of our other priorities, you know, it just means that that line just goes up a little higher, under which there are more items that we're not going to get done as we put more energy, staff time into this, into climate change adaptation. So it's a worry, but what can we do, right?
It's the constant challenge of management, whether it's program management or organizational management. It's the constant challenge of it. And I'm going to see a glass half full. The challenge is good, rather than, oh my gosh, you know.
So a full glass would be getting more tangible resources, more money. And what is the chance that more money will shake down to regional boards from state government?
Loaded question there. I think the best strategy to make it rain resources is to utilize the highest leverage opportunities. And I would say that that looks like conversations via the board chairs, and also conversations with our state board liaison when we have meetings, and whether they be board meetings or individual conversations with our state board liaison. I think this type of item allows the board collectively to form an opinion on that, that the chair then can move forward in his discussions, and I can move forward in my discussions about accessing, putting in budget change proposal items to the governor to increase number of positions.
And does it break any of our organization rules for board members when we have our regular discussions with state senators and assembly people to bring this up, to lobby for more funds for our regional boards?
As a representative of the board, I think it actually does. I think that tends to want to come up through the individual agency, that is regional boards to state board.
I can speak on that. The strong recommendation from state board is that for introduction of certain of bills, they want them to be channeled through state board rather than individually. Now, if there is a state representative legislator who is promoting a particular bill, certainly, you know, encouraging that is consistent. But as individuals, we are discouraged from saying, you know, I think you, Mr. Legislator, you should propose XYZ bill. The recommendation is to bring this through through the state board, and we do have a very effective a person at the helm of that responsibility. His name again escapes me. Or legislative.
Rob Eagle.
Eagle, very on top of things. And what happens is that budget proposals are being made, and then they're weighted in terms of their potential success, and then they're being presented, and then often then the legislator makes recommendation, has further questions. It's a bit of a challenging process, but there is a whole process where this gets elevated. And the reason it gets elevated to state board level is that that way it's not viewed as being a single want from, you know, one local region, but a priority established state board wise.
And I want to fully disclose that state board is aware of the need and want for and have attempted strategies to get more positions associated with climate change and climate change adaptation. That's something that's on the table pretty regularly in our discussions and in the proposed budget change proposals we put forward as a collective agency, the state and regional water boards. It hasn't made it yet beyond that level. It's my recollection.
Yeah. But so, and I was going to hold off an input until I hear from the rest of my colleagues, but I would like to do it now because I think it's appropriate. When you're saying, okay, you know, what can we do? We need to remind ourselves that we wear two hats. We're regulators, but we also need to view ourselves as facilitators. And that's an area where I think we certainly can raise the bar whenever possible, because there are projects sometimes that linger in agonies of paralysis by analysis, where you have, oh, we need one study. And I'm not talking about Weave, a water board, but, you know, other entities. We need a study. Oh, we need a study to review the impact of a study. And it's, meantime, time goes by. And what I'm suggesting, based on what we're hearing so far, we don't have a heck of a lot of time on our hands here. There is a sense of urgency, in my view, that we need to take action. You know, if we take the example of Heal the Ocean giving us how much water is being discharged in the ocean, that water could be used very effectively to offset a high priority basin. We have some right here where every day we have millions of gallons of water being discharged in the ocean, and yet we have basins that are high priority. Doesn't make sense. And I'm not suggesting to be a rebel, you know, bypassing CEQA, EIRR, NEPA, and all the different regulatory requirements we have. But as facilitator, I think we need to daylight and constantly remind of the importance of taking action. And we do have the facilitation role we can take. And some of the facilitation role we can take, and we have done that successfully in the past, is assisting with some of the grants opportunities. But when those are provided, what is disappointing is if, you know, 2 years later, it's still being the paralysis by analysis of some agencies to move forward. So that, I know I sound passionate, so, but I think, you know, your point is well taken, Bruce. I think collaboratively, us board members and with staff, you know, we can help a little bit, you know, raising the red flag, so to speak. I think that was an analogy you used.
So my very brief clarification question is, I heard that telling legislator X, vote yes or vote no on this bill, or bring this bill, create this bill or that bill, that we should stay away from that. But I guess my follow-up question is, can we speak to legislator X and say, hey, did you know that we really do need some more money at regional boards so that we can take care of all our priorities and add climate change in a big way to our plate? And right now we're having a lot of trouble. Are you aware of that? And you know, it's just that kind of a conversation. Is that precluded as board members from us doing?
No.
Okay, that was
no, and
question.
You know, I've done it, and you know, I haven't been handcuffed so far, I think part of our job, you know, the legislators look at us as being people who are informed. You know, we're the boots on the ground in some of the issues associated with our own specific region, so highlighting those, nothing wrong with that, and I think there's a difference between, you know, being providing information and doing, you know, heavy-duty lobbying. That's a separate thing. There are people paid to do lobbying. In our case, we're volunteers. And, you know, but we certainly can daylight issues.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Chair. Yeah.
All right. So next on my right, did we have any question or comments to Dominic?
Sure. I have a couple of comments. Just one brief one on the lobbying thing. The way it was explained to me is, as appointed board members, we're part of the executive branch, and so when it comes to promoting legislation or budget or taking public positions on legislation, the executive branch prefers to have centralized control over that. On the other hand, for example, Bruce, you wear a different hat as the mayor of Marina, and your appointment to the water board, I wouldn't think in any way limits what you would do wearing that hat, or as a private individual. It's basically what you're doing as a member of the water board in that capacity. But I think it's great to give legislators general encouragement to focus. So I had a couple questions for Dominic. First, you said in reviewing the fourth climate change assessment, I think it was called, lower surface flows and increased groundwater extraction were expected. Was that a Central Coast prediction or a statewide prediction? And was that basically just based on higher variability of rainfall? Because I'm not sure I understand the connection of that otherwise.
Well, the findings I presented are directly out of the fourth climate assessment's regional report, so they are specific to the Central Coast. All the causal factors and basis for the findings I can't really present to you, having not studied them in great detail. I think they're in there, so we can go back and provide
you. All right,
I'll go
back and look. I had the same question.
Yeah, we can also provide you some direction. I think in general, the expectation of drought periods being so long and frequent results in an overall expected depletion of groundwater, and where you see examples of that. So, and the fact that we don't have, even with Sigma, we really don't have the tools in place to prevent it yet. It's probably, there's going to be lag time issues and a lot of effort to kind of get up to speed on managing drought. And Ruth Langridge at UC Santa Cruz has made some specific inquiries or kind of research into how drought management differs from climate change adaptation in terms of addressing groundwater issues. And so really was hoping to have her come speak with us, but I think we could possibly pursue that at another time.
Okay. I had a similar question on why Salinas Valley is one of the most vulnerable places in the state to climate change, but I sounds like I should go to the report for that.
Yeah, it's probably better than having me mangle the the reasons.
And finally, I had a question in terms of what we're doing with our permitting of waste discharge facilities on climate change. And I don't know if this is the appropriate time to ask it, or if I should hold off on that.
Well, I guess it depends on what the question is, but
okay.
Maybe you could give us a...
Sure. I know that we have talked for some years, and I think we've moved on it. I'm not sure of requiring in those renewal applications for the waste treatment plants that they speak to the question of sea level rise, because, of course, we all know that sewage flows downhill, and most of our waste treatment plants in the region are very close to the coast. And I'm just wondering if we're doing more than simply putting a box in to check. I suspect we are. And to what extent we're actually requiring long-range planning that's meaningful and judging the meaningfulness of that, or if we're basically relying on the Coastal Commission to do it, which I know has been relatively aggressive too.
Yeah, I think to date we have let the Coastal Commission lead in some of the big decisions like Morro Bay, and I think we are very interested in developing the language to insert into our new orders. In terms of the long-range planning requirements, that's still language that needs to be developed at a statewide level to be consistent, and the Division of Water Quality has actually undertaken an effort to identify the best strategies for developing the language based in part on input from the stakeholder community, the dischargers themselves. And so they're conducting a process of figuring out what's the best way to get you guys to, you know, do this longer range planning effort. And then we'll develop language with them so that we're all at the state level working a little more consistently. And I'm happy to let John or Harvey expand on that.
That sounds like it answers it. So essentially the answer is, to this point, the Coastal Commission's been doing the heavy lifting in the obvious, the low-hanging, the low-hanging sewage stuff. And in terms of actually incorporating into our regulatory process, we're waiting on the state to pull together a statewide approach, which presumably will be more than just language.
Yes, and I don't think we would delay if we felt we had, you know, the approach in sight. I don't think we need to wait for a broad statement precedent from the state board. I believe we would proceed, but I also think that that is a timely effort that will support our
efforts. And given the resource questions we were just talking about, it seems silly for us to do a bunch of work to do something that the state board is in the process of doing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So if I can add to that, not so much on the infrastructure vulnerability analysis, that's kind of what we were just talking about right there, but more on the water supply security diversification side of the equation. We've actually spent quite a bit of effort on that side. We've actually had some discussions in Santa Barbara as an example when we met with the city of Santa Barbara probably a couple of years ago. We talk about Morro Bay as an example. Cambria has come before you many times, and that was a diversification example. Later today, we'll talk about another one. So we've been pretty active in that facilitation influencing role in that piece of the strategy. Less so, I think, in the infrastructure vulnerability side of the equation, though.
All right, so to wrap up our questions,
Yeah, so thank you so much for the presentation. Appreciate it. Obviously, this is long overdue, and I feel like it's extremely important and part of our imperative, really, to deal with climate change. So just to follow up a little bit on the permit aspects of it, are we looking at different permit terms and being more creative in how we work with agencies and permit language to allow some more flexibility for the prioritization of groundwater recharge and reclaimed water and things like that? And I don't know if that's a Harvey question or a Dominic question.
I feel like it's a Harvey question. I do have some reporting from their program, which might allow me to kind of pull out some responses, but it might be easier if Harvey wants to jump in.
So
available, Harvey?
Well, I was just going to add, Dominic a little bit of time to look. Dominic surveyed the different programs in our organization to see how they were they aware, were they adapting, and how they were adapting, and that's what he's referencing there.
Thank you.
This is Harvey Packard. So what I think I can say is we are doing our best to be facilitative, as the chair has mentioned, and trying to work with the agencies on their permits and get them done in a timely fashion and as quickly as possible. For instance, the one we're in here this afternoon, it's not yet reached its five-year term, but we're reissuing it now because they have a need to get the recycling facility underway. So I think that's an example of what we're trying to do.
Okay, and then with other jurisdictions, are you talking about, you know, different opportunities for discharge areas or different terminology that would allow for a broader array of uses in different areas?
Yeah, we're open to anything. We're encouraging, where it's appropriate, potable reuse projects. We've talked a little bit about Morro Bay. One of the things that's happening in Morro Bay is that Morro Bay and Cayucas are splitting. They're each building a new wastewater treatment plant. And we've been talking with Cayucas about reuse. They are going to initially treat to tertiary levels, so it'll be available for recycling. They're looking at possibly working with the county and other agencies to use direct potable reuse into the Whale Rock Reservoir. So there's a lot of things on the table, and we're definitely encouraging as much as we can and open to discussing all the options.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Hunter, any question? All right, so Dominic, thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Chris Reed. He's in the sustainability, he is the sustainability manager for the city of San Luis Obispo. Mr. Reed leads planning and implementation efforts to bring down greenhouse gas emissions and enhance community resilience to the impacts of climate change. Chris previously worked as a consultant helping agencies throughout the state create or update their public safety and climate action planning documents. And I've asked Chris to address this issue of collaboration from the perspective of someone both working at a city, but also through his involvement in one of the regional collaboratives. The one in particular we're talking about is the Central Coast Climate Collaborative. And Chris, I think this will work. If it doesn't, I'll just start advancing your slides.
Thank you, Mr. Rock. Chair Wolf, honorable board members, thank you for allowing me to speak today. I think I want to it's based on some of the comments I've heard from Mr. Rock and some of the items I've heard from the board members, I want to refocus the presentation just slightly, so bear with me at the beginning of this. But so I'm Chris Reed, I'm the sustainability manager with the city of San Luis Obispo. I'm also a steering committee member on the Central Coast Climate Collaborative. And before we begin at all, I just wanted to acknowledge something that I don't think we often do when we have these conversations. I heard it from Board Member Young and Board Member Gray that this is a deeply emotional topic. It's easy when you see 1,000 of these presentations to just see the projections and forget that. But I just want to honor the fact that as people, this is an emotional topic, but also as staff that are stewards of public dollars and the public good, this is a very emotional and challenging topic to grapple with. And I think in some of the conversations around adequacy of resources, et cetera, I think start to get to that point that it's not just a work plan issue, it's a can we do this issue. And so I think it's just important to say that. So I just want to give some background on myself and the city of San Luis Obispo and what we're doing right now. So as Mr. Rock said, I have a background in doing public safety planning, land use planning, as well as working on some climate change components of IRWMPs throughout the state, as well as doing climate adaptation plans and really leveraging the state resources, including the adaptation planning guide, to develop adaptation plans for regions as large as the Western Riverside Council of Government to as small as the tiny retirement community of Laguna Woods in Orange County. So I've definitely over the last decade seen this field shift and really mature, which is exciting and appropriate. The city of San Luis Obispo really is strongly committed to both addressing the causes and impacts of climate change. We run on 2-year budget cycles. So in the 17-19 fiscal year financial plan, we identified climate action as a major city goal for the first time. We created my position, and we also started to organize. So one of the things I want to talk about is a little bit about how we're thinking about collaboration both in our agency, just briefly, and then we'll transition to how we're thinking about collaboration throughout the region through the collaborative. So one of the things we're looking to do through our organizational structure is create an Office of Sustainability, which brings stormwater, natural resources, and then climate resilience, climate adaptation, and greenhouse gas emissions reductions into one office that's housed in the city manager's office so that we're close to the administrative functions, but then also able to look at these issues in a collective manner. So I want to say that that's a nascent organizational approach. Hopefully that will bring sort of cross-cutting collaborative opportunities throughout our agency. But I also want to just stress as well that this is a nascent approach. This is something that's emerging. And while I can talk broadly about how we intend to work, I'm certainly not in a position to respond to any specific water quality projects that are happening currently. So we'll be talking at a higher level than that for sure. Just in October of this year, the city of San Luis Obispo committed to carbon neutrality by 2035, one of the most ambitious greenhouse gas emission reduction targets in the nation. One of our first actions to back that up was to join Monterey Bay Community Power, a regional community choice energy producer that provides carbon-free electricity to its jurisdiction. So we see that as a big opportunity. And you know, as was previously discussed by Mr. Rock, when we look at how we get to some of the more manageable climate impact futures, it is through dramatic greenhouse gas emissions reductions by mid-century and then carbon neutrality after mid-century, which are dramatic and aggressive, but required to get to where we want to go. But also, as noted, 2018 was a record greenhouse gas emitting year globally. The train is speeding forward, and we are locked into climate change impacts. And so the things we're talking about, while we have some sea level rise impacts that sound like 2100, et cetera, as we all know, as people that read the news and see the world with their two eyes, the climate is rapidly changing, and we are locked into these impacts. That said, the difference between 2 degrees of global warming and 2.5 degrees of global warming and 3 degrees and 3.5 degrees are significant. They are not linear, they are exponential. And so one of the things I wanted to note is that while this is focused on adaptation, certainly the nexus between mitigation and adaptation is critical, and that one of the best ways to reduce our exposure to the costs of adaptation is to commit directly to greenhouse gas mitigation. I know that's not directly the purview of this board necessarily, but to the extent that that can be facilitated, I think it's critical. So where I was getting with that is that as we're moving into our 19 to 21 financial plan, we're actually going to be committing the Office of Sustainability to continue to implement greenhouse gas emissions reductions, but we'll also be looking forward to a state requirement to update the safety element of our general plan. And if we were to just sort of do, you know, government code 65302, minimal compliance, we could have a policy document that met the standards of the law, but we really want to be aggressive and bold and have a safety element of the general plan that provides an overarching adaptation and resilience framework for all of the actions that each of the departments in our city do, as well as how we interact regionally. To that effect, we've actually submitted a grant through the Caltrans SB1 Adaptation Planning Fund for $500,000 to do a really deep vulnerability assessment to think about how our transportation system, how our water system, how all the systems in our community are affected by potential climate change impacts, but not just the physical assets, but also the economic assets, as well as the social assets. And so hopefully we'll be able to move forward on that and start to have a really critical in-depth look at how we can become more resilient to climate change. So I think it's important as we move forward, and we started doing adaptation work at the state 10 years ago, sort of what is adaptation? Adaptation is this extra thing we're doing, right? Like we have this scope of work and now we're doing adaptation on top of it. I think what's really clear now is that's not the right frame for it. Adaptation is actually everything. Every single thing we do has to have an adaptation component to it. When we look at how the change in climate conditions is affecting hazard variability and what that means for our economy, what that means for our local tourism economy, what that means for water flows, for the items this board regulates, what that means for air quality, for items that, you know, air pollution control districts regulate, et cetera. There's no part of our economy or our society or our ecology that will be untouched by the severe impacts of climate change. And so one of the things we're trying to do is really think about, you know, not having adaptation as something else, but as something that, as our basic modus operandi, we operate thinking about resilience and adaptation. But that's really hard. And we used to think that the future would look like the past, but now we know the future is much more variable. And we know that planning for wide variability systems is complicated. Dynamic environments by themselves are complicated, and they require significant monitoring, flexibility, collaboration. But when that likely wide range of future impact is even greater, it requires even more monitoring, even more flexibility, and even more collaboration. And that's just exacerbated by how complicated the regulatory environment is and how complicated the planning expectations are. You know, at our city, we have an emergency operations plan, hazard mitigation plan, safety element of the general plan, climate action plan, we're developing an adaptation plan, an IRWMP. If we were at the county, we'd have an LCP and an implementation of that LCP. And all of these things have expectations around adaptation. The point is that this underscores how critically important collaboration within an agency and across the region is to be able to do this work, since each of these disparate items in themselves will be using climate projections, best available climate science, and to the extent that we can share knowledge resources across agencies to share understanding of best available science, but also then have consistent projections for all the different planning work we do, it's just critically important. In the interest of time, I'm gonna skip through a lot of these slides. They've been adequately covered previously. All this is to say the state is moving aggressively forward in this space, which means more expectations for us, as you all know very well. So understanding all of this and knowing that as a, you know, as a local government staff member, you know, maybe as a regional body staff member, this means that we have to be area experts as well as understand everything about climate science, as well as understand how the climate and the entire economy and our entire ecological system will look for the next 50 to 100 years. We took a deep breath and said, maybe we can collaborate and create an organization that will allow us to share resources and share knowledge. So I'm here primarily or secondarily to talk about the Central Coast Climate Collaborative. We are just a collaborative of nonprofits, local governments, community groups from the Central Coast, and our mission is to engage our communities in the region to help ensure a resilient and low-carbon Central Coast that's prepared for the impacts of climate change. Here's a map of California. The Climate Collaborative structure is actually a formal structure. It's a proper noun when you go to the state and you talk about a collaborative with a capital C. Folks generally know what that is. There are a number of active collaboratives that already exist. LARC, the LA Regional Collaborative, is extremely, they are very high functioning. They have executive director, they have staff, they do lots of really interesting work. Same with the Climate Collaborative in San Diego. Then there's sort of more emerging collaboratives like our collaborative, which is just trying to get its footing and see how we can work effectively. It is composed of the six county region of Santa Cruz, San Benito, Monterey, San Luis, Ventura, and Santa Barbara. And that slide, there we go. And this slide is a little bit dated now. We are a dues accepting organization. We also believe in open collaboration and sharing. So we're sharing all of our resources and time with anyone in our area that would like the information or would like assistance. But these are the members that are currently dues paying, and we use that money largely to help support with administrative costs and other items. We're governed by a steering committee that's composed of local government staff, nonprofit staff, state agency staff, and then we're also supported by folks from the state university system, as well as we have some federal government support as well. And so we meet monthly and we share what the work we're doing in as it relates to climate action, climate adaptation. We also share best available scientific resources and policy-based resources, and then support each other in the work that we're doing. Again, in the interest of time, we'll just go through this quickly. This started in 2015. We had ambition to start hosting annual summits in 2017. Those will likely be biennial summits now, so we're looking forward to 2019. And this 2017 was an important time for us. It's when we as an agency first applied for a grant. I think that's, or as a group rather, applied for a grant. I think this is really where we're seeing the value of this organization is the ability to go out and receive dollars for our membership to do some of this work that may not be funded that is critically important. So the EPA and FEMA support us with technical assistance grants, and through that we were able to train local government agency staff members as well as folks in the nonprofit field on how to do vulnerability assessments, how to access best available state science, and how to leverage that into community resilience products. We see ourselves as conveners, as knowledge sharers, as grant submitters. One of the great things about having this organization is that we can be co-submitters with nonprofits or with a lead agency in submitting large statewide grants, and then the members can benefit from that grant without having to go through their procurement processes. So we can really streamline access to state scientific resources this way. We've been writing letters of support for various initiatives and grants. In fact, our SB1 grant that we just submitted came with a letter of support from the collaborative. And given that the collaborative structure is part of a larger statewide structure called the Alliance of Regional Collaboratives, or ARCA, there's actually value in those letters of support. And we've heard from state agencies that they've been valuable in evaluating our grants. And then finally, we've been surveying our region on needs to try to understand what would be helpful, what could we use as local governments, as counties, as regulatory bodies, et cetera, what kind of technical information can we go out and get grants for to provide for future work? I'm gonna skip through some of this information around the shared impacts and exposures. I think Mr. Rock and Mr. Barnard more than adequately covered that. The short of it is to say the climate's changing and we're exposed to that, and it's a big deal. This is one interesting item that we are taking very seriously, is the electrical grid vulnerability. We're sort of at the end of infrastructure systems, both to the north and to the south, whether it's through PG&E or Southern California Edison. We've also seen the electricity systems being causes of wildfires. And so having an understanding of how our electric system works and being able to support good, whether it's maintaining clearances of transmission lines or whether it's engaging in more renewables, et cetera. We've been working together to ensure that's happening and supporting each other in that. I just want to be sensitive to time, so I'm going to skip through a couple of these and just point out some interesting items. So this is of our membership, of staff members from our membership. We conducted a survey on issues they thought were important. And one of the things that we are really intentional about, again, is understanding that it's not just the climate that's changing in the next 50 years, but that our social, demographic, and economic systems are changing as well. So in no time in human history has a population aged in the way that we are aging. There are going to be more 75 and 85 year olds in 2050 than we've ever had before, right as climate change is happening. Our economy is going under rapid change as well. And so, as you can kind of see illustrated here, and sorry for the washed out colors, these issues around affordable housing, aging population, access to transportation, et cetera, are emerging as really important issues for us. And these were blue, I apologize for yellow. It's not a it's a suboptimal presentation color. So obviously there are a number of top assets at risk. What's important to illustrate here is that some shared interests with this regulatory body and ourselves are wastewater infrastructure, drinking water infrastructure, and other ecological components that have to do with water. And this is really the one I wanted to point out, is just that there are right now dozens of, they may not be called this, but planning efforts that essentially deal with climate adaptation going on in our region right now. Lots of local coastal program updates occurring, lots of emergency operation plans, lots of local hazard mitigation plans. Right now, we're conducting a countywide multi-jurisdictional hazard mitigation plan. This is our opportunity to think really clearly about how the impacts of climate change will affect our entire region. And I think that to the extent that we can collaborate with you know, that's typically done by fire departments and public safety personnel, but clearly the opportunity to collaborate with folks like the Water Board, there's an opportunity there to think about how impacts from drought to our economy, our community, public safety, et cetera, can be mitigated. IRWMP is in process. I think that is adopted IRWMPs of our membership, and then climate mitigation plans and adaptation plans are in progress as well. We asked what would help. The central response was more resources and funding. But I think one of the interesting responses is really like, how do we make decisions about implementing strategies based on assessments? So this is when we see Dr. Bernard's lines on that map, and then we think about, okay, well, what does that mean from a local government policy perspective in the context of what the Water Board has to say, what this, you know, what the Coastal Commission has to say, what the OPC may have to say, et cetera. How do we translate that into actionable policy? And that is an outstanding question, and one that a lot of work remains to be done in. One of the other things we do is host workshops, and we host informational items. And so we were fortunate enough to receive some funding and use some of our dues funding to host an additional resiliency workshop up at Cal Poly. And it was very well attended, and hopefully we were able to build some capacity and share resources through that effort. As previously mentioned, we've partnered on a number of grant proposals and have over a 50% win rate, which I think is pretty good. If you're in the grant writing world, that's a pretty good hit rate. And so that's where we are now. What's ahead? We're going to continue to look to grow our membership. We're going to support the workshop that's here on Monday, and continue to look at grants. And then what really we want to do is start to become more expansive in our membership, but then also obtain the resources to have permanent staff so that we can move forward more effectively. And I think really this was the question that Mr. Rock led with when we were first discussing this presentation, is that yes, for all the agencies that are involved in this organization, adaptation is something new that most folks are dealing with. And this is a collaborative structure that we've created to try to respond to that newness, but also the urgency of the work. And so quick reflection on what's working. There is now a very connected network of local government and nonprofit staff in the region that otherwise would not have existed. I can talk to Dr. Wise West in the city of Santa Cruz if I have questions about X, Y, or Z in a way I could not have before. We've been able to share some of our projections around extreme heat and what we're doing and how that integrates with our transit system with folks to the south of us as well as to the north of us. So having that resource sharing system really, really works well, and a lot of work has been done that otherwise would not have been done. What isn't working is just simply that we don't have the resources to have a staff person maintain continuity. This is essentially volunteer work on top of all of our other work, and as we all know, that can be the first thing to be deprioritized. And so what do we need? We just need more contribution, we need more membership, and then support and commitment to continue moving forward doing this work. That was really rapid. I hope that made sense. I'm open to any questions that folks might have.
Okay, I'll look on my right. Any question?
Thank you. That was quite a speed presentation, but it was interesting. I don't have any questions other than to say I'm glad to see this collaborative work going on.
Ms. Gray?
Yeah, I just want to say thank you. I was at the SLO workshop and then the right. one at Carpinteria a couple weeks ago or whenever that was. But I appreciate all the work that Climate Collaborative is doing. I think it's really important. And I think, just to sort of emphasize that, it's easy to think about this as just one more thing that we have to do. But climate is obviously the through line through and the lens through which we have to view all of our work. So I appreciate all the work that you're doing. And thanks for the presentation.
Dr. Hunter?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Reed. It's nice to see you here. It's nice to meet you. And I'm hoping that the regional board, in laying out the strategy and priorities and looking at our program resources, that we are going to be able to contribute to this this collaborative, broad collaborative effort. And we certainly are beginning to, I think we're in a good position to highlight the intersection between water quality, which is our bailiwick primarily, and climate change and how our resources, program resources, can work in common ways. I'm curious, you mentioned several times membership is important, mm-hmm. to increase membership, expand membership. Is that primarily as a feature of education and awareness and collaboration, creating more collaborative alliances? Is it also a feature of finances? Is there membership cost? And then as the last part of that, what grants do you have currently? What grants are you looking at to sustain this group? Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chair Member, or Board Member Hunter. Excellent question. So on if you go to centralcoastclimate.org is our website, is the organization's website, and the membership, we are a dues-paying membership organization, but the memberships are very affordable. They're something like $1,000 per fiscal year, and that slides up and down based on how big you are. The idea really there is we're hoping to get folks that are contributing to the network and are committing to the network. And so just by, we found through organizations like this, and we see this with large organizations like the Urban Sustainability Directors Network, that just it's a small amount of money ensures that a staff member has vetted that this is an okay resource to participate in, and that they then have time to commit to. Because we only work as a network when we're supporting each other and actively engaged, and when people are not engaged, then the value isn't there. And then, with those small amounts of money, they can pull up, and then we can either use those for some of the regional trainings, some of the direct costs with that, or one day, like the Los Angeles Regional Collaborative has used their dues to, as I noted, hire a full-time person to actually direct the work. I think there was one more question, is that?
Yeah, I was curious what grants you currently have and any that you are working towards that you see multiple year, hopefully, types mm-hmm. of funding opportunities.
The grants that we currently are working under and that we have submitted for are agency-specific grants that are supported by the collaborative, with the commitment for the collaborative to engage with that work and then to transmit back out to collaborative members. So I mentioned the SB1 grant that we just submitted. There's several grants that we submitted in partnership with the RAND Corporation to do downscaled heat mapping and other downscaled primary climate science conducted for our region, and that will be transferable out to our community. We also are supported, we some of our membership participates in the Civic Spark program, which for marginal dollars, we have a full-time, recently graduated person through the AmeriCorps, essentially it's an AmeriCorps fellow, and we've been leveraging those to help staff some of our events and then act as agency or organization staff a bit.
I'm really glad to hear that. We've also had very, very good luck in having really bright and very talented young professionals just getting started. And this is a really good place to put folks who are just starting their career to get directly exposed to and see local level challenges, because that's really what we're talking about, is how the local jurisdictions and regulations, ordinances, and et cetera, how those are gonna actually frame the change in the right direction. So these are all good things, and looking forward to hearing how this expands and grows going forward as fast as possible.
Thank you, Chair Wolf. Thank you, Mr. Reed, very interesting presentation. You mentioned early on that the city of SLO was working on also addressing causes of climate change, and I think mitigation. Mm-hmm. Can you give us some specific examples of what SLO is either doing or has on the front burner in terms of that?
Yes, thank you, Board Member Young. The city is committed, so the first thing to note is that we committed to climate action through our two-year budgeting cycle, having it as a major city goal. Through that, we have since received direction, unanimous direction from council to pursue, to update our climate action plan to achieve carbon neutrality by 2035. But planning is one thing and doing is another, and we've been actively committed to doing as well. So first, as I just noted, we joined Monterey Bay Community Power. So we will be receiving carbon-free electricity starting in 2020. We recently updated our zoning code to require electric vehicle charging infrastructure in all new development throughout the city moving forward, in certain cases, redevelopment. We're installing something like 40 chargers in public spaces, EV chargers in public spaces. We are doing about 1.5 megawatts of solar installation on site. We're committed to about $500,000 in lighting retrofits on site. And then we're also actively pursuing REACH codes so that future development will be potentially carbon neutral.
And what about the city's fleet of vehicles? Are they going to switch at some point to EV?
So as part of the chargers that we are installing, 10 will be supportive of fleet. And then we have active procurement process where we are transitioning light-duty fleet vehicles. In the meantime, our heavy-duty fleet vehicles are fueled currently by renewable diesel, which is a not an ideal end fuel, but as a bridge fuel, lowers our municipal emissions.
Thank you.
Do you advertise your meetings in newspapers or radio or social media or any other? I don't think I've ever seen a notice for one so that the public can get more engaged in this and learn more about this.
Thank you, Board Member Harlan. The collaborative currently has only met, or we meet regularly as board members, as steering committee members, rather, and those are internal phone calls. When we do have some of the capacity building workshops, we do our best to share those among our agency membership, but your point's well taken that broader outreach could benefit the region more directly.
Thank you, Chris, for your presentation and all your work. I like when you said, the doing is more important than the planning. And I think a tangible step, as you've mentioned a couple times, is San Luis Obispo City joining the Monterey Bay Community Power. And one way that you can help as a city is to do collaborative education of your residents so that they know, A, they will be getting 100% carbon-free energy, B, 30% of that is renewable energy, and it will be increasing as close to 100% as it can in the future, and that costs a little bit more money usually. And so helping your residents understand that as part of that new power generation, they can pay a little bit more and get a greener portfolio of energy coming into their homes, and B, they will be getting a rebate. So they'll be getting a 3%. If they spend $100 a month, they'll get $3 of that back at the end of the year for every dollar they've spent. And the Monterey Bay Community Power can do so much as its own entity, but its members can glom on and provide different incoming directions of information. So there's a lot that can be done besides joining in order to make it more effective. And one non-intuitive thing that I've learned is that the Monterey Bay Community Power is actually discouraging residents from adding solar to their homes, that there's such a solar glut on the market that the Monterey Bay Community Power is more encouraging something that you're being involved with, and that is electric vehicles. And probably the holy grail is to invest in energy storage so that solar power gained during the glut time of day can be stored to be used, you know, in other parts of the week or the days when there's not a demand for it. So energy storage of solar generated seems to be more the holy grail, and supporting electric vehicle networks seems to be a higher priority than adding solar. But it's not intuitive to me, and it's probably not intuitive to a lot of your residents either. But thanks for being part of this collaborative. I didn't know about it, and I feel educated having learned what you've taught today. So thank you.
Thank you, Board Member Delgado. And I would just add that there's a clear energy water nexus as well, right? A lot of the treatments that are in place to either get to tertiary or potable reuse are highly energy intensive. And so one of the exciting things about Monterey Bay Community Power being able to provide carbon-free electricity is that there isn't the carbon penalty for treating water to that level.
So thank you for your presentation. And you know, I wanted to drill a little bit more on the doing versus the planning. And you know, one item that comes to mind, and I realize that you know your group looks more on the programmatic, strategic aspect of things. But if we take, for example, the city of San Luis Obispo and its goals of becoming carbon neutral in the near future, you know, certainly working closely with CAL FIRE makes a lot of sense, because as I'm speaking, I'm looking at the hills behind me, and all it would take is one significant fire to negate all the good work being done. And I think a good example and lesson that we need to learn from the previous presentation is the recent fires we had. You know, there's some very disappointing results in terms of the impact to global warming from all these carbon that was sequestered that is now up in the atmosphere, aside of also toxic materials. So I think there's importance to look at that. Another one, and forgive me if maybe I come across as being a little bit picky about the terminology, but this is going to be because of my background. When we use the term carbon-free energy, need to be careful when we use that term. I would highly suggest you use the term low carbon. There is no such thing as carbon-free energy, because it does take carbon to have an infrastructure of power generation, transmission, and distribution. And even if you take solar energy, it takes, even with the best high efficiency thin film technology, it takes about 5.5 to 6 years of energy production to offset the carbon footprint to build these devices. So, you know, I don't want to be Scrooge here, coming to the holidays. That's not my style. But I want to mention that. My colleagues will certainly attest to that. And then the other item, again, reflecting on the doing versus planning, I would encourage, you know, your staff colleagues at the city to give us an update on where the city stands right now with their Title 22 Recycle Water Program for Agriculture. This is a project that's been in the works for 3 years. The State Water Board has provided grants to the city to do the final analysis of the recycled water to be provided. The city of San Luis Obispo is in a high priority basin as designated by DWR. In the last 3 years, we have several hundred million gallons of water that could have been avoided from extraction by using it for recycled water purpose. So, you know, maybe you could have your staff and maybe Aaron give an update to our staff on where that project stands.
Is that Mr. Floyd?
Yeah.
Aaron Floyd, sure.
Yeah, and you know, this gets back to, I think, the comment I made earlier about the sense of urgency and trying to move forward with mm-hmm. what I call shovel-ready projects. This mm-hmm. is one perfect example. So, but overall, you know, certainly want to thank you very much for giving the presentation as taking a regional effort. But I think, as I shared earlier, it is important to embed in these strategic efforts the sense of urgency, mm-hmm. so we don't end up, you know, 3 years from now to still look at some, you know, plans and where are we going, because as we know, we don't have a whole lot of time on our hand to reverse the course. So thank you very much, and I think it's great that the city has committed, you know, through forming a new department. You're called a department, or
it's a maybe division.
That's a big word. Division, sure, because sure. You're it for the department, right?
The division is staffed by the natural resources manager, myself, and our city biologist in the city manager's office.
Yeah, so you work with Freddie Ott and
Mr. Hill.
Mr. Yeah, okay, perfect. So thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you
Appreciate
very much.
It. So, Dominic?
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Our final presentation for the climate change item is from Mladen Bandov, who will be talking about integrated water resources management in the face of climate change. Mladen is a water resources engineer for the County of San Luis Obispo. He supervises the regional and watershed programs of the Department of Public Works Water Resources Division, which oversees the integrated regional water management and stormwater resources planning efforts for the county. Mr. Bandov manages projects and programs that address drought, flooding, and long-term water resource resiliency for the county. Thanks, Martin.
Chair Wolf, members of the board, thank you for having me here. I'd like to give a presentation on the IRWM program and the Stormwater Resource Plan programs that we have at the county, and what we've done recently and how we've addressed climate change with respect to water resources. First of all, Department of Public Works formed a Water Resources Division about 3 years ago, and in there, the IRWM program was set, and one of its missions was one to facilitate the program, but also look at regional resiliency in our infrastructure, look at drought contingency, and also the groundwater program. So I'm not going to be able to speak today on the groundwater program. That's another division. Carolyn Berg in our office manages that with the groundwater sustainability plans. But I do want to acknowledge that the county has been involved with the six priority basins in our county for that. And within those planning efforts, there are climate change, or to the degree looking at adaptations and mitigation. All right, so first of all, just a little bit of background, and you probably well understand the IRWM program that we have here. Within the hydrologic, the Central Coast Hydrologic Region, which is the region of this board, there are six IRWM regions, of which the San Luis Obispo County is one. It was formed starting back in 2005 with a plan. That plan has been updated a couple of times. We're right now in the middle of updating the plan, which will be due out next year. Our region, just as a kind of a note about IRWM regions, is that they're not necessarily county-based. Ours happens to be, and so is Santa Barbara. But the other regions are more water-based or water purveyor-based. They do cross county lines when and where appropriate. We just happen to be fortunate that our county has chosen to look at and solidify our leverage our strengths regionally within our program. So what is the IRWM program and the plan, and what is its intent? Obviously to create a united framework, but what does that mean among all the stakeholders? And for us, it meant creating a number of goals: flooding, groundwater, water supply, ecosystem, and communications were our main kind of goal areas, with a number of objectives under each of those. And if you notice, water quality is sitting on the outside there, but really water quality is spread out amongst all those goals. So is disadvantaged communities, and so is addressing climate change. So within all those goals, we're focused on what each stakeholder might be interested in. Water suppliers and water purveyors are obviously interested in water supply. Ecosystem and watershed interests are obviously interested there. But we wanted to make sure that water quality, climate change, and disadvantaged communities were covered in all our goals and objectives. So our region is governed by or run by a group. We're formed by a memorandum of understanding. Right now there's 29 local agencies, water purveyors, nonprofit organizations, and the county, under the auspices of the Flood Control District, is the lead agency. So all our grant administration goes through us. Right here on this slide, it shows the subregions that we've kind of divided. There's nothing jurisdictional about those subregions, but it helps us define, when we talk about climate change especially, what impacts and what are the common effects that we'll see in different regions. North County here obviously is the inland area, and it has a different set of impacts than the North Coast or the South County does along the coast. Seawater intrusion obviously is not as a big driver in the North County as it is for coastal aquifers, for instance. So the IRWM program is under the Department of Water Resources, and what they did was what they do is they create a number of plan standards. And the most recent plan standards was updated in 2016, and our plan has to be updated to comply with those new standards. Most of the plan standards are just updates throughout, but the biggest change was that climate change was now given more rigor that we had to address, and we had to look at both adaptation and mitigation, and those standards are sprinkled throughout all our sections. There is a climate change section, but our objectives, our regional description, and everything has to address climate change. So that was the one of the biggest changes for this go around. The other part to that was that we had to do our vulnerability assessment, and I'll get into the details of that in the next few slides, according to or at a level equivalent to DWR's Climate Change Handbook for Regional Water Planning. And so that was, again, providing a little bit more rigor, a little bit more of the process, and that's what drives what I'm going to show you here on what we have done in this past year. In addition to there, where we did have a list of prioritized vulnerabilities in our prior plan, we actually went through this workshop and this process to deliver that prioritized list. So in a nutshell, the vulnerability assessment, and it was just one section of that handbook, looked at four particular steps: doing a literature review, identifying key indicators using questions to find that, and looking at our regional characterization for that, identifying vulnerabilities, and then prioritizing them. So that was basically the plan that we, the approach that we used in our assessment. So the first thing that we did was we engaged with a consultant who had updated what we had already in terms of our assessment, which we had one, and had we had created a questionnaire. And I want to just kind of thank all the stakeholders who have participated in this questionnaire. It was like 2 to 3 hours long. It wasn't one a simple survey. It was very detailed. But that really helped us when going into the workshop. Everyone was prepared, and they had everything that they needed to know, or they had their questions answered ahead of time. And then the workshop was where we collaborated and really got to work on agreeing on what those priorities were. And so it made it really, even though the vulnerability survey that we put out took a while, I appreciate that everyone took time. We had over 30 or so respondents who went through each of these 35 questions, these 35 vulnerabilities under these 7 categories, and really looked at it and provided great results. I want to also highlight the Farm Bureau, our local Farm Bureau. I want to thank them for, they sent out the survey to their members, and we had 19 responses from members of the SLO Farm Bureau, which really filled out the agricultural interest that was lacking perhaps before, but really balanced it out, the agricultural, the environmental, and the urban sort of interest when it comes to water supply and water quality.
One additional sure. question. I'm glad you pointed out that your survey included the ag industry and their perspective mm-hmm. and experience. So you're saying you had 35 respondents in your survey. And so what other areas, what other stakeholders or business and industries were involved in the survey?
Yeah, thank you. That was a great question. It was mainly to our members, our RWMG members, which are almost all the cities, a lot of the community services district. We have several nonprofits, including the Land Conservancy, the Central Coast Salmon Enhancement, Morro Bay National Estuary Program. Those are kind of a nonprofits, both resource conservation districts that are in the area. We put it on the website, and we kind of sent it out in notices. So whoever, other members of the public did respond as well. We had a few local citizens who responded. As part of the survey, prior to this and updating the plan to get people onto the mailing list in the summer before, I did do a number of outreach events where I went to different communities and invited people to sign up onto the mailing lists and be engaged in the process as we were doing it. So hopefully they had looked at it, weren't too scared for what it would look and take to do, and really scanned down and found the interest that they wanted to address and provide. I do want to point out we do have hydropower here, water demand, water supply, water quality, sea level rise, flooding, and ecosystem. Hydropower is one of the questions in that chapter 4, section 4 of the handbook. We don't have any hydropower plants in the area here, but that is something elsewhere in the state that needed to be identified as a vulnerability to climate change. Okay, so that survey was done at the beginning of January. The input of that survey not only was identifying the vulnerabilities, there was also a prioritization in there, so we went through the prioritization process. The first thing that was created out of that survey was this draft assessment. And so it's very detailed. It's about 30 or so pages. All those questions, it's split into those 3 sub-regions, North Coast, North County, South County, in terms of what vulnerabilities we might see. So a question might be something, would you see effects to your crops as an increase of temperature? That might be a question. And so that would identify a vulnerability to agriculture. Would your water demand or water supply portfolio change as a result of declining basin levels or something to that effect? And I can definitely share what our assessment is prior to our plan if you like. It's up on our website.
Yeah, is the survey actually posted on your website, the actual questions?
I don't know if the survey is open anymore. I don't want to do more work at this point. But the draft assessment is, and it will be included in our plan update. And
yeah.
So we can definitely take more input. We're not finished with the plan, and when we do go out for adoption and get input, we would love to get comments back.
Yeah, no, I'm just more curious about knowing what your survey
yeah.
questions were in the first round. So
yeah.
I'm guessing that the total set of questions will be part of your report.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. It'll be an appendix of the plan, right. And that'll be incorporated into the plan itself.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm.
So what that survey did was it prepared everyone for the workshop. And I really want to also highlight and thank you staff, your staff here, for attending that workshop that was part of their outreach. Dominic, thank you. And we even had Department of Water Resources there. We had a lot of our participations, I think one of your board members. Yeah, thank you. And it was actually a 3-hour meeting, but it was highly efficient, and we finished on time, surprisingly, and everything got done.
Give me the recipe.
Yeah, well, and I think if there was a lesson learned here, it was preparing everyone ahead of time, and everyone did the work that they needed to do. But that was unintended, or at least I didn't know how it was going to go. But we went through each one, and the identification worksheet gave people an opportunity who either didn't do the survey or who had additional things to say and to comment on the different questions. Here's an example on the left there of water quality. I can't read it there, but it says, you know, what are some issues related to water quality? And I do have the list here if you were interested in particular questions. And then people commented and added specific things that they've identified that might be impacted by climate change. The second part, and probably the place that we spent most of our time with, or at least the most of our debate, was how to prioritize these. And we used three quasi-metrical ways of looking at it. And that initial parameters were just to help frame the prioritization, to give people a place to start. It was looking at exposure, sensitivity, and likelihood to the impacts of climate change. And I also want to thank Chris for helping out create that set of that scale. Was a vulnerability going to be not exposed or highly exposed to climate change impacts? Was a vulnerability going to be highly sensitive or not as sensitive? And it gave us a rating scale, a place to start, which gave us a way to categorize high, medium, and low. These we had about 30 or so. Oh, thank you for zooming in there. Looking at different vulnerabilities. So there at the bottom there, the first vulnerability is water-dependent industries. We had, you know, rating of 3.11, which of exposure, which showed it as exposed. And again, there were some definitions that helped guide people who were answering the survey on what exposure, sensitivity, and likelihood meant, and that came to a score. Again, it was a place to start. This was quantitative in a sense, but not definitive. So from that prioritization worksheet, what the next thing is we brought those draft results, both the assessment itself and what we came up with the prioritization. And we came up with, from that meeting, from that workshop, 6 very high. We wanted to accelerate or at least identify 6 particular vulnerabilities higher than everything else from that workshop. And so, for instance, in the water demand category, drought-sensitive groundwater basins was prioritized as very high. Insufficient in-stream flows as a water demand vulnerability, also very high. Water supply from coastal aquifers, very high. Drought-sensitive water systems, declining seasonal flows, and I think the last one was, pardon me for not having that on there. Just look real quick. Increased flood risk due to wildfires, and that was under the flooding category. And those were the very highs, but we still had many highs, medium, and low priorities. Again, it was just a prioritization exercise to figure out what the IRWM program wanted to focus on their efforts. So that happened in February. What also happened was we took the objectives that we had, and we looked at the 5 requirements that the new guidelines had. How do you adapt to changes in runoff and recharge? Consider sea level rise effects on water supply conditions, projects and objectives that reduce energy consumptions. Consider the strategies of the California Air Resources Board's scoping plan. There was 18 strategies in there. and the help with reduction in energy or carbon use, something. Thank you. And then the fifth one was carbon, consider options for carbon sequestration and renewable energy. And the objectives and those five requirements were cross-referenced on the right there. And then those objectives help guide what management strategies we would use. And then we looked also at the and evaluated the 30 or so management strategies that we have, and looked at how do they impact or address energy efficiency, emission reduction, and carbon sequestration. So here's an example of one of the projects. During the summer, we met with each of the RWMG members and walked through all their projects. It took a long time to do so, but we were very careful and methodical about making sure that we understood their project and we understood how their project addressed all the project review factors. And so here's an example of one of the projects. It scored very high with related to climate change. This is City of Pismo Beach's Central Coast Blue recycling project. And it, you know, you can see the check marks on the left there in the column that address the different prioritizations that the vulnerabilities we just prioritized, the very high and to medium to low priorities. So IRWM is one program. The Stormwater Resource Plan, another plan that we were helping with on a regional effort, we were one of three partners, the City of San Luis Obispo and the City of Aurora Grande, creating a regional plan under two specific grants, one by the State Board and one by Department of Water Resources. And what a Stormwater Resource Plan does is it looks at quantifying multi-benefit projects that deal with stormwater and dry weather runoff capture. And it's now a requirement under SB 985 that updated the code that you need this plan in place to be able to fund, to get state grants for that, some specific state grants for that. The Stormwater Resource Plan right now is in a final draft form, and we're submitting it this month to the State Water Board. And part of that Stormwater Resource Plan, your regional water board here and the state board have been involved and been on a technical advisory committee. So again, to Dominic and Lucas, thank you very much for your participation and helping out and help guide how this plan got created. So I just want to identify or show what were some of the multi-benefits that the plan addresses for projects: water quality, water supply, flood management, environment, and the fifth one is community. We didn't take a quantitative analysis on community as a benefit. We looked at it was more non-quantitative as a benefit, but climate change is in that kind of other project review factors. But these are just these direct quantifiable benefits that I wanted to just kind of point out. And they look at making sure that a stormwater capture project either maximizes on the multiple benefits or show how it can maximize on multiple benefits. And those are the projects we want to support and elevate. And all Stormwater Resource Plan projects ends up becoming IRWM projects. And so that's the connection there. They all go into the same plan where they also have to do a storm or a climate change analysis as well in that part of the loop. So this is the last slide here. Our adaptive process for this going forward is that we look at the area of vulnerability with respect to climate change. We look how it's being impacted in the physical setting, stream flows, groundwater basins. Then that drives how we prioritize and our objectives, and like such as, you know, we want to create reliable water supply. And then that drives the need for our strategies, such as recycled water or other strategies that we have, and then that drives which projects we end up supporting and submitting for grant opportunities. And then hopefully when those projects are implemented, they in fact, you know, do a loop and help adapt and reduce to the impacts of climate change in the physical setting. And right now we are, for the climate change, as a group, we're looking at an annual meeting to go back over our vulnerabilities and our prioritization and to meet and review what new data we have, what new management strategies, what new tools we have available, and what projects, and start to help influence a project to incorporate these strategies, both mitigation and adaptation, into its planning process. So with that.
Thank you. I'll start on my left. Mayor Delgado.
Hi, thank you for your presentation. Can you go to slide 7 where you showed the 7 vulnerability areas? So I'm aware that normally human values trump non-human values, and looking for the sort of what I would consider the non-human values, sea level rise, you have coastal habitats, ecosystem health habitat, you have climate sensitive habitats, and there was environmental water demand. Environmental water demand, does that mean the needs of ecosystems, aquatic ecosystems, more or less?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Okay, so I'm looking there and I see those environmental related features, and then I go to your slide number 10.
Okay, thank you.
And you have categories that include water demand and water supply, and you have 6 water demands, and there's where I think that we've lost the environmental pieces. So on that list of water demands, are any of those 6 relevant or prioritizing the non-human values, those 6 water demands?
And I'll apologize, this slide was just for being able to see as an example.
Okay.
It's not a complete list.
Gotcha, okay.
And I do have the list here, and those categories are on the backside of our page, and I'd be happy to share that with you.
Okay, so in the whole package, do you feel confident that this exercise, this approach is not leaving out or deprioritizing too far the non-human values?
I don't think it is. I think we had a robust conversation about that part of it. Definitely, we did have a lot more of the urban water supply folk there.
Right.
But we had agriculture, and we had great representation from our environmental steward organizations. Yeah,
okay.
So that was included in there, yeah.
All right, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. I can attest to that, having been there, of the robust dialogue and input on environmental concerns.
And I'll just also say that, you know, certainly, you know, the IRWM, just working on it in Santa Barbara County and knowing that we share information, Mladen's on my list and I'm on his list, and I was also at the workshop, and there's a broad array and discussion around all of the, you know, all of the requirements that ecosystems have and every place that water touches, so.
Mr. Young?
No questions.
Mr. Johns? Ms. Gray?
No.
Dr. Hunter? Well, I don't have a question, but I want to thank you for coming, and I regularly see your smiling face at other county meetings with RAC, with Board of Supervisor. I know you have come to ALAB a couple of times too, so thank you for your ongoing efforts. And my little parting comment of a personal view on the aspects of water vulnerability is that the long-term solution is about water augmentation, water conservation, and innovation. And in fact, the city of San Luis Obispo, in the mission of the Sigma City of San Luis Obispo Edna Valley, in its mission statement, it embeds those 3 values. And I think those are found in some of the suggestions you have there. So okay. Thank you for your good work.
Okay,
all
you.
Right. So this concludes the speakers. And at this time, I do have 2 speaker cards, and what I wanted to do is to finish this item before we take a lunch break, and we also have a closed session, so I wanted to use these time. I will start with Ms. Okay, one more? Okay, all right. And then I close the speaker card for this item. So I'll start with Ms. Hillary Hauser. 3 minutes, and I know you have a handout, but unfortunately, I cannot pass it around because we passed the deadline. And in
yes.
fairness to, you know, our rules of providing these by Monday noon, you know, I want to be consistent. So don't take it personally. I'm not trying to be
you
Mr.
Scrooge. Midnight last night was a little late. Chair Wolf, thank you so much, and members of the board. Hillary Hauser from Heal the Ocean. And the letter is up there, and the only if anybody wants it, and also hard copies of the inventory that you talked about today, and I encourage everybody to go on the Heal the Ocean website for the interactive form of this. You can buzz around and see exactly what's in everybody's NPDES permit. Page 2 and 3 of the letter has bulleted points where of areas that we have multitude studies on that can be acted on right now with the studies that we have. I totally agree with Chair Wolf's statement that, you know, with the assessment of the reassessment of the assessment studies, what is it? Assimilation? What'd you say?
No, I said paralysis by analysis.
Ah, yes. Well, we have that ourselves. And in the 20 years that Heal the Ocean has been working on this issue, my office is full of engineering study, wastewater management studies, study after study, which we can't, they're still good, but they're gathering dust because they're not acted on. It's just very hard to get them going, and that's where the regional board could come in with some help on permitting and things like that. Number one, I really want to thank you for getting this climate change up to the public. If there's a stakeholder process, Heal the Ocean would like to participate in it, and what I'd like to do is send you the 30 studies and engineering reports that already exist. My biggest fear, we talk about moving quickly, my biggest fear is the loss of institutional knowledge. A lot of people are retiring right now, the regional, the state board, and they're putting new people in that don't even know what happened before. So before I pass out, I really want to have these things down and then to discuss a different approach to things. For example, in Santa Barbara, we have recycled water from the city that very little of it is used, 6 million gallons a day, and we're using, what, 0.5 something? And it's right next to the cemetery that's dying for recycled water, but it's the city water, not the Montecito water, and so it's being watered with drinking water. And so this territorialism, I think the regional board could help with that. There's been a suggestion that a wastewater, the recycle plant, can put Title 22 plus water on a disposal field like a cemetery instead of going this way and that way. Anyway, I'd like to have us participating in this process. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Hillary. And with your level of energy and enthusiasm, you have a long life ahead of you, so,
you know. Thank you.
But thank you, though, for, you know, your ongoing contribution to water quality. So thank you for your good work.
You too, thank you.
And you have a great new year.
You too.
Thank you. So, two remaining speaker card, Marla Sadowski and Richard Sadowski. So we'll start with Ms. Sadowski.
Hi, I'm Marla Jo Sadowski, and I'm representing Homefront Morro Bay. We're a rather newly established environmental justice group, and we're a grassroots group. We're originating out of Morro Bay, as the name suggests. However, we are our goal is to be in a diverse amount of communities. Our idea is to bring the local lower income people, which with today's sliding income scale, more and more people are finding themselves slipping into non-medium income households and going all the way down to the homeless. I'm a Climate Reality Project leader. I'm an environmental activist. I have been an organizer for ever. I just like to introduce myself and to introduce Homefront Morro Bay, because we're going to be, we have already established, we've had a meeting with Ms. Schroeder and Dominic, your environmental justice representatives here. We'd like to make an appointment or to speak with Monica Hunter, since you're the representative for the state, right? The board here, the regional board?
I'm not representative of the Los Sussex area, but I live in this area, and certainly I would be very interested in speaking with you at any point.
Environmental justice representative on your board.
I've been designated the board liaison for environmental justice. I'd be very interested in knowing what your views and knowledge that you've been gathering and so forth, so we can follow up on that.
Okay, thank you. And I'd just like to say that we'll be working on trying to get funding. What I'm hearing today from your staff is that one of the problems that you've had is funding and resources for the climate adaptation and reduction goals and objectives that have to be put forth immediately. And I'm very happy and encouraged today by this meeting, and have a good rest of the day. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Sadowski, 3 minutes.
Good evening. I'm also very encouraged by this meeting and the collaboration that's going on with the other interstate agencies. One of the things that I wanted to kind of mention is I'm also on the Morro Bay Planning Commission, and we're updating our general plan update and dealing with a lot of the climate change issues. In Morro Bay right now, one of the things we're dealing with is a wastewater treatment plant adaptation project, and I also sat on the Wastewater Reclamation Citizen Advisory Board representing the Planning Commission. And for several years, I've been bringing up the issue of greenhouse gases and mitigation on that. And, you know, we could take climate change and take a sliver of sea level rise and put it on a petri dish, and it's a lot more complex than that. And the project that we have has ignored the amount of greenhouse gases it's going to take to a managed retreat should be moving it back. What we're doing is a leap 3 miles in, and the amount of greenhouse gases to pump sewage there and then effluent back has been not even, you know, when I mention it to the consultants, they said, oh, we're not there yet. Well, you know, California is there. and I think that the regional board could take a leadership role in integrating that and making sure that that's part of the plan. And the other thing that I would like to say is with regarding to groundwater, one of the pieces of infrastructure that is being ignored is the collection system. I'm a collection system expert, and we have exfiltration issues in our groundwater. And so if we could prioritize that, safeguard some of our critical infrastructure, and maybe get that working together with the Coastal Commission. It'd be awesome. And to follow up with Dr. Wolf's mention about climate change and the Paris Agreement, my wife and I were going to go to the COP24, which is being presently held in Poland, which I have relatives there, but we weren't able to go, obviously, because we had a fire in our house. But I'm really, you know, also a climate reality project leader from, you know, Al Gore's group. And one of the things that I think that what is referenced is it's a climate crisis, and we should treat it as that. And we don't have that much time, and we need to get it pushed. And thank you very much again for this presentation and the encouragement and hope, because that's what it's about. Thank you.
Would you please state your name for the record?
My name is Richard E.T. Sadowski, and I'm home front, Morro Bay.
Thank you very much. So this concludes this particular item. Before we totally ended, was there anything that we needed to add to this topic?
Yes.
Mr. Robertson?
Did you have
just
more?
Just a couple of closing comments.
Okay, go
closing
ahead.
Closing comments?
Okay. Yeah, I think it's apparent from the participation of our speakers that we're not alone in this project. We have a lot of assistance and a lot of collaborators, potential collaborators, both as citizens and as people who work for the Water Board. I think some of the take homes included that there is a need to raise the sense of urgency about the issue. Speakers and board members both echoed that. And there's also a need for us to increase our understanding of the specific issues. Chair Member Delgado mentioned his specific interest in understanding key aspects of groundwater inundation. I think that's very encouraging to see that level of interest in the scientific basis for our decision making. We are going to prepare a work plan around the three strategies of using our authority and our influence and our assistance, collaborating, and filling the gaps in our knowledge. And we will bring you a status report of that hopefully in the coming year. Thank you.
Thank you, Dominic. And, you know, this particular topic goes back to 3 years ago when Fran was a state board member who since then retired, suggested that we each region should have two important liaison, one environmental justice and the other one was climate change. So this is the meeting that is a follow-up to the broader meeting that all of us attended 2 years ago and then this year. And then the next step after this meeting is that we're going to further zero in on this issue. So this is not a, okay, we covered this topic, we're good for the year. This is basically the beginning of a journey. So thank you for putting this presentation together, getting our local speakers, and also coordinating our speaker from the federal perspective. Mr. Robinson?
Yeah, I wanted to thank the speakers as well, both those here, our departed USGS speaker, and I also wanted to single out Dominic for pulling this all together, the work that went before this presentation. Unbeknownst to most of you, Dominic was wrangling because one of our speakers bailed on us last week, and Dominic cleverly got a great replacement for our content. And I also want to single out Angela, who's also been participant in this process of changing us and how we do our work with respect to climate change.
All right, so this will close this item, and now we will have a closed session,
right,
which requires an hour and 15 minutes.
Right, correct.
Because I'll let you do the little update, but I would like us to reconvene at 20 past 2, which will make it the 75 minutes you requested.
All right, so the board will be going into closed session to decide whether to initiate litigation as authorized by Government Code 11126E2C. And during this closed session, the board will also be discussing pending litigation under Government Code Section 11126E2A. They'll be discussing the item that's identified in the agenda as 16.3, which is Plains Pipeline LP Refugio Oil Spill.
Thank you,